CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, Professor Dan Hebert from the Department of Geography, a specialist on immigration and co-director of the Canadian Network for Research on Terrorism, Security, and Society. Greetings, Dan. Great to have you here.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, let's begin with this question of immigration. It's a terrifically important subject today for Canada, both in terms of kind of policy and demographics. How did you become interested in that field?
Sure. There were two routes into that field. The first was I arrived here in Vancouver and at UBC in the mid-1980s, in fact, the year of Expo 86. And at the time I arrived here, I had just come from teaching for a couple of years in Ontario. And I didn't notice much difference in the complexion of the classroom between there and here when I first got here. But within just a few years, there was a remarkable transformation in the students that I was standing up looking at when I was lecturing in my classrooms. And I think my classrooms went from, say, 10% minority students to probably 30% minority students within maybe 3 to 5 years. And it really interested me. I was very curious as to how all of that happened. And so I started thinking about what did immigration policy look like? How was Canadian society changing with respect to that kind of policy? So that was a beginning point in the very early 1990s. And then just a few years later, the Government of Canada unrolled this program called Metropolis, which was an attempt by the government to think through an academic lens what was going on with respect to immigration. They did a road trip. Somebody came to UBC, said, hey, we would love to have people from Vancouver and UBC particularly working on this. And it was then that I got interested in the policy dimension of all of this. So the first few years was just learning about how society was changing. And then after that, in the mid-1990s, I really got solidly into the policy framework, thinking about, well, why do we have, say, 200,000 immigrants instead of 500,000 immigrants? Why do we have these categories rather than those categories? So that was the kind of journey that took me. It was starting with my teaching, and then it was with this invitation from the Government of Canada.
So do you see it as an extension of the discipline of geography, or do you define yourself as a cultural geographer?
Yeah, yes and no. Geography has long had an interest in cities, which, of course, is where I come from. There is, as you say, the discipline of cultural geography. But I think the issues that I'm really interested in, the social policy issues around immigration, diversity, Canadian society, they're very interchangeable in terms of disciplines. I mean, when I'm at the kinds of conferences I go to, workshops I go to, I'll be talking, sitting beside me will be an economist, let's say, on one side, a sociologist on the other, someone in history, someone in political science, et cetera. All of these issues have to be taken seriously if we think about the kinds of rapid transformation. And if I could just add one comment on that. When I think about Canadian society, as someone who's lived in that society for now several decades, too many decades maybe, I think that through immigration, we are engaging in one of the biggest experiments of all time in Canadian society, which is we are actively transforming the cultural base of Canada. And no discipline is going to have a hold over how we figure that out, how we figure out how to do it, and how we figure out how to deal with the outcomes of that. We need all comers, so to speak.
Are there some models in the world? Do we have the examples of some other countries, perhaps smaller geographically, that begin to encounter these sorts of demographic shifts?
I think we have, well, I'll answer that question in two ways. We have lots of bad models. I won't go there, but if you want to, I can talk about how they're doing it wrong here, there, and everywhere. We have some good models, but the good models are not so much countries, they're cities. Because this transformation is occurring on a local scale. I mean, we have a national policy of immigration, but what does that really mean? People immigrate to Canada, they get a Canadian visa, but they settle somewhere. And it's that somewhere that matters. So a place like Vancouver is transforming far more rapidly, say, than Quebec City or Regina or what have you. So when we look at models, I think the place to look is at the city scale as much as anything. And there's some great models of how that's being done. In terms of nation-state models, I think Canada is as good as any country out there in terms of trying to figure this out.
Does that suggest we are leading the way, or are we catching up, so to speak, in terms of, again, demographic shift, cultural change?
Yeah, we're doing both. It's I'm terrible about answering the both and rather than the either or on questions like that. We're leading the way in many ways demographically. Vancouver and Toronto are among the world's very most diverse cities. Just to give you an example, I was looking at the statistics the other day for just 2012. We haven't got them yet for 2013. We're still a little bit before we're going to get there. But for 2012, Canada received permanent immigrants from almost 200 countries in just that one year alone. And the same thing happened in 2011, and the same thing happened in 2010. Almost no other country on Earth has that level of expanding diversity. And again, if I could just amplify that point a little bit, because I think it needs amplification, it's not just that we get immigrants from, say, 193 countries or whatever the number is these days, but from any individual country, we're getting immigrants that have different religious affiliations, we're getting immigrants that have different socioeconomic situations, we're getting people who come, let's say, as, well, China would be a great example. From China, we get highly skilled migrants who have advanced degrees from top universities, et cetera. We get middle-skilled people, we get family reunification, and we still get a few refugees also from China. So we get this huge gamut of people coming in under various categories. Some are deeply a-religious, some are deeply religious in a variety of different religions. So even if we would just take a country like China, we have tremendous diversity within that particular origin population. And this is, you know, this is writ large across all of the places we're getting people from. So more and more, I'm working with scholars in Europe and who have coined this new phrase, but also mentality, which is called super diversity, which is the idea of diversity within diversity. We're all coming to terms with this at the same time. All of the, let's say, the societies of the global north are all getting this kind of transformation, Canada faster than others, but we're all getting it, and we're all having to come to terms with what it all means.
So can you characterize differences in terms of immigration policy today and maybe 20 or 30 years ago? Has it changed or has it evolved?
Yeah. There have been breakpoints and there have been evolutions. The two biggest breakpoints happened in the 1960s. Until 1962, Canada still imagined itself as a European post-colony country with mainly French and English people, and Europeans were part of that equation, but not much more. And in 1962, Canada made a tremendously important choice, which was to tear up the list of preferred versus non-preferred countries. And so that was the real starting point. I think Canadians always like to hear that was 3 years before the United States did it, but never mind. So that was our first transformative moment. It took us a few years to figure out, well, where would we go if we were no longer going to choose people on the basis of their skin color or cultural sensibility or Christianity or post-Christianity as a religion, where do we go? And then it took 5 years to invent the point system, et cetera, and we moved in that direction. So that's one. The 60s was a big transformative moment. The second transformative moment was the 1980s. And in the 1980s, what happened was Canada, for the first time, began to come to terms with the fact that we had a major demographic change. As everyone I'm sure knows, we had a baby boom that lasted from the mid-1940s to the mid-1960s. And by the mid-1970s already, we were in a below-replacement fertility regime in Canada. And at first, people thought, well, that's smart. I mean, that's good. Environmentally, that's a smart thing to do, use less of the Earth's resources and all that kind of stuff. But very quickly, people began to realize by the 1980s, well, wait a minute, we have a transition problem, a transition challenge, which is how do we get from a society that's got a high fertility rate to one that's got a low fertility rate where you have a lot of population aging? And in the 1980s, that was realized, and then a new attitude began to emerge in the 1980s on immigration, which was let's keep it high all the time. And regardless of economic circumstances, regardless of anything, let's just have a relatively high immigration rate for Canada to have what I like to call a soft landing demographically. So Canada's got much far fewer of the kinds of challenges that, say, South Korea would have, or Japan would have, or Germany would have, countries that now have rapidly declining populations. I think people will find this interesting. Japan and Germany both will lose in the order of 20 million people over the first half of the 21st century. How do you function as a society if you lose 20 million people? It's almost, you know, two-thirds of the population of Canada. And because of the choices we made in the 1980s, we're going to have a soft landing rather than that kind of hard landing.
Right, fascinating. Now, is there a direct correlation between immigration numbers and citizenship and new citizens?
Yes, and Canada is very much at the front end of the wave on that particular phenomenon, in the sense that of all the countries that are accepting reasonably high volumes of immigration, we have the highest rate of transferal from permanent residency status to naturalization or citizenship. Now, the government has very recently changed the parameters for that, so we may see a little bit of a slippage in our bragging rights on that particular front. But over the last 20, 30 years, we've really seen that citizenship has been a very prominent part of our evolution as a society. Now, that has lots of interesting dimensions to it. And one of the most interesting dimensions is what we found is that Canada has a high immigration rate, but not everyone stays. Something in the order, I mean, you know, we can debate endlessly about these numbers, but something in the order of a fifth of the people who come here, you know, take a look, spend a little bit of time, and then either move on somewhere else or go back to where they came from. What that means is we have a growing Canadian diaspora of people who've come and gone. The biggest piece of the Canadian diaspora is in the United States. It's a million strong. There's a million Canadian passports, so to speak, in the United States. Second biggest is Hong Kong. Something in the order of 300,000 Canadian citizens living in Hong Kong at any given point in time. And then there's another number of other places. Beijing is becoming a big Canadian diaspora, other parts of China. And now we actually have to ask questions of where does Canada end? You know, we have these maritime boundaries and the U.S. border, but that's not necessarily where Canada ends because of this major fluidity and circularity of our population.
I think that's a wonderful question. Where does Canada end?
Where does it begin? Where does it end? Yeah.
Yes, right. Well, we've always answered those historically, but in terms of the contemporary situation, that's what I think is fascinating. Let's switch a little bit to this research on terrorism and security and so forth. How do you bridge your research on immigration with your work or concern, at any rate, with security and terrorism issues?
Yep. That's a challenging question. It's challenging because there are many people who would be very reticent to see the words immigration and security put in the same sentence, right? Because the worry would be that if we think of these things together, what we might end up with is a stereotyping of immigrants as security risks and so forth. So I'm cognizant of that viewpoint. But at the same time, I think we have to consider security policy and social policy together. I think we've made a huge mistake in most of our societies in separating out these kinds of things. I mean, to my mind, one of the biggest security risks we have in Canada and in other countries is the social marginalization of large chunks of our population. If we persist in having large groups of people feel that they are in a hopeless situation, that their kids have no hope for a better future, well, surprise, surprise, some people are going to begin to think that that's a rationale to react with violence. And so I think we need to layer these interests in our social policy and our national security, and that's the place I would start. Canada has to be a society of open opportunity, and if it isn't, we've got a security risk.
Well, do you find at the governmental level and the policy level there is a kind of exchange between those involved with kind of social policy and security?
Minimally. I would say minimally, yeah. We call bureaus of intelligence, we use that term intelligent, and it turns out they're very smart. I mean, the people who work in Canadian intelligence services are really smart people. They understand this point. But the opportunities for government, the phrase that's often used or the terminology that's often used as government is siloing, you know, the idea of a grain silo. And when you're in that tube, you can only look up, you can look down, you can't look across. And that's the phrase that governments, bureaucrats use to describe themselves. It's not something we've pinned on them. It's they understand this themselves. And what they're getting at is in government, you tend to get locked into a role. Bureaucracies work with divisions of labor. And it's rare to see that. And this is why, actually, governments value working with academics, because we help them connect with each other in ways that they can't do so easily in their own day-to-day lives. So when we enter into the equation, we often are very interdisciplinary. We bring then questions that spill over from one ministerial viewpoint to another, and we kind of force people to get in the room together that might not be in the room together. So it's kind of funny. We play a connective role that I think is quite an indirect but quite useful aspect of how what happens when we work with government.
Wasn't this situation that you're describing part of the final report on 9/11?
Yep.
And a strong recommendation was to remove these silos.
Yep.
And you would have thought other Western governments
yep.
would have naturally read the report in great detail
yep.
and respond.
Yep, yep. And so what that's done, Ira, is it's led to an increasing enthusiasm in government for what is often called soft security policy. So hard security policy, we all know what that is, right? That's CIA, MI6, CSIS, doing behind-the-scenes investigations of person X, Y, or Z who might do, you know, one bad thing after another, whatever the case may be. And that's one side of the security process. But increasingly, we're seeing the rise of an interest in soft security policy, which is working with communities of interest, right? So trying to develop linkages. Just as an example, you know, in a couple of the most recent major issues that have hit the news in terms of security in Canada, members of the community came to the security forces of Canada and said, hey, I think there's a problem happening here. You should check out, you know, this person over here, because the way they're talking, we're worried, and you should be worried. And it's that kind of trust that is hoped for in soft security policy, that we know that in any given community we might be talking about, 0.01% of that community is going to radicalize towards violence. And I hate using that cumbersome phrase, but it's a very important phrase we need to think about. Radicalization is not necessarily a bad thing. Radicalization to violence is the thing we have to worry about. And only a tiny fragment of a fraction of any community is going in that direction. And if you're just doing hard security, it's the needle in a haystack problem. If you can involve yourself in soft security issues, you have a much easier way of going in. The risk of soft security, though, of course, is in potentially painting communities in general as risks. Which communities are you going into? Which communities are you trying to make these relationships with? So it's a fraught issue, which makes it an interesting issue, which is why it's academically interesting for lots of people.
So are you reasonably confident that Canada is alert to the issues that worry the general public vis-a-vis security, terrorism, these matters? Or
yes.
Are we complacent because we're a happy country
yeah.
and we're a small population?
Yes and sort of. I won't say yes and no. Yes and sort of. I think Canada does a pretty good job of one side of the security equation, and that we haven't yet come fully to terms with the other side of the security equation. So two sides, right? One side is, I think we all want to feel safe and secure. And in order to make us feel safe and secure, that means that governments have to find the people who would threaten that in one way or another, and they have to stop them from doing whatever they're doing. For example, someone who wanted to, actually a couple who wanted to set off a bomb at the Canada Day celebration at Victoria. We saw a couple of individuals who wanted to derail a train going from probably Toronto to New York, I think was the routing that they were thinking about. These things have to be stopped, and we want to feel safe and secure. But on the other hand, we also want to feel the opposite, which is we want to feel safe and secure from counterterrorism. We want to feel our privacy is respected by government. We want to feel that if we're not a person who's going to, let's say, plant an explosive device, that we could talk about that without surveillance coming down and bearing upon us and scrutinizing what we do. And that worry about the implications of counterterrorism policy is, of course, most acutely felt in our marginalized minority communities. And it's there which I think that area of security policy, I don't think we've advanced enough in. That's part of why I worked with some other people to start this TSAS organization. We want to examine security from both of these vantage points, from the threats to our safety, but also from the point of view of the threats to minority communities.
And it's complicated.
Yeah.
It's very complicated. Well, we're kind of winding up, but I have one question for you, and that is, if you could change one aspect of Canadian immigration policy,
okay,
what might that be?
Well, I have a worry about immigration policy. And you asked earlier about whether we've gone in revolutions or evolutions. And I told you about the two big revolutions in policy. What I didn't talk about, so now I'm going back 15 minutes and answering the question which I didn't have a chance to answer before. What I didn't talk about is the evolutionary side of immigration policy. And what we've seen over the last, let's say, 15 years, maybe 20, is a very steady movement towards an immigration policy that's only focused on the economic. Immigration is more and more thought to be an economic feedstock for Canada. So if we have labor shortages looming, let's get more immigrants. Let's target the immigration selection to those who can immediately work in the labor market and so forth. What we've been doing is systematically eroding the numbers and also, but more than the numbers, the mentality about immigration, including Canada having a role in helping disenfranchised populations in the world. We have a smaller government-assisted refugee intake now than we had 10 years ago. We have a smaller number of asylum seekers. Given the way we've really ramped up our border security, it's much harder to come to Canada to be an asylum seeker. We have about a third now of the asylum seekers coming in than we had a few years ago on that particular issue. So we're systematically shifting all of our emphasis to economic. And I think of immigration as something that needs to be much more combinatorial, something that is dealing with helping the world sort out its human rights issues, as well as dealing with the idea of being, you know, generative and propulsive to economic things. So if I could do one thing, I would try to swing the pendulum back towards that more combinatorial attitude and operational processes of the immigration
and quickly,
system.
Quickly, any change in security policy that you would like to see or that you would initiate?
Yeah, well, what I'm trying to initiate is that issue about how do we bring minority communities into security policy in a way that they feel unthreatened by that policy and that they can actually even contribute and thrive under that policy. Because, you know, it doesn't help a minority community if there's some tiny number of members of that community that want to do bad things. They're going to be hurt just as much by that as anybody else. So bring them in more into the policy process and more into the mentality of being a solution rather than part of a problem.
I think that's very well stated. That's fantastic. So thank you so much. Thanks to Dan Hebert of the Department of Geography for joining us this evening. And stay tuned for future profiles of unique voices that make up the Faculty of Arts at UBC.